Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. In our first case this morning, 2023-0480, in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Elvin Mollandato. Mr. Martin, good morning. Happy New Year.
Good morning and Happy New Year, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. John Martin, on behalf of Elvin Mollandato, may I have 5 minutes for rebuttal? There's a line between efficiency and a rush to judgment. It's a line that's defined by the rules of a procedure, and in this case, the rules of appellate procedure. And it's a line that was crossed, respectfully, by the 8th District in this case when they issued an en banc opinion at the same time and therefore in control of the panel decision that was decided in this case. And so I would submit to the court that two central issues evolve in this appeal. One, is a panel decision required as a prerequisite to an en banc opinion? And then two, what is the effect of the error if the court agrees with me as to the first point that there was an error? So let's get to that first point first. Why do I say that a panel decision is a prerequisite to an en banc decision? Look at the plain language of Appellate Rule 26A. 26A2D, here's my best argument, states that a panel decision shall remain, that's the word, remain the decision of the court in the event the en banc panel is evenly split.
But there wasn't a panel decision.
Correct, Your Honor. And you can't remain if you don't exist.
Was the Court of Appeals allowed to en banc a conflict within its district?
The Court of Appeals is allowed to correct an en banc within its district, but only in the manner prescribed by rule. And that manner requires a panel decision first. And the state takes issue with that, claims that it can be done sua sponte without benefit of a panel decision. But the state's reliance on two law review articles that are entirely focused on the federal rules of appellate procedure is misplaced. See, in our rules, 26A begins by stating that en banc consideration happens when there is a conflict between panel decisions. Federal rule of appellate procedure 35, which we attached as supplemental authority just to make sure that the court had it in front of it, states that you can have both en banc consideration as well as en banc reconsideration. It also talks about the fact that the criteria for en banc consideration or reconsideration is more than simply whether there's a panel. They have a standard that is of great importance, that's my words, not the rules' words, but akin to what this court employs when deciding whether or not to grant a discretionary appeal. And so you have a federal rule that's intended to prevent conflicts and to keep uniformity from the beginning. It is, if you will, proactive or prescriptive.
How does what the 8th District did here prejudice your client?
And which is my second point. And it prejudices my client in several ways. First of all, this court in McFadden had discussed an en banc procedure at a time when Rule 26 was still in its genesis. It hadn't yet been promulgated. Maldonado made reference to the fact that the Rules Commission was working on a rule even as the court was deciding Maldonado. But the Maldonado decision mentioned the fact that the decision to decide a case en banc would itself be something that is subject to a review by this court for an abuse of discretion. In other words, this court's going to look and say, did the 8th District, or any other district for that matter, abuse its discretion in determining that a conflict existed to begin with? We can't have that in a situation where there was no panel decision to begin with. That's number one. And the notion that we're saying, and had that panel decision been able to come out, it may very well have been that there would have been no conflict. As we discussed, and I couldn't go too far into this out of respect for the fact that the court did not allow merit briefing on my latter two propositions of law. But we talked about the fact that this case could have been decided without creating any kind of a conflict between Howard or Jarman, as the 8th District en banc maintained it did. The appellant below, Maldonado below in the 8th District, had said, look, this was a resentencing. This was ordered as a resentencing. It should have been a resentencing, a plenary resentencing. Had the panel decision gone that way, there would have been no conflict. I'd be in a position where my first proposition of law might very well have been the 8th District abused its discretion in finding that there was a conflict. I can't do that because there is no conflict. So there's my first level of prejudice. Second level of prejudice is the fact that of the three judges assigned to this case, only one has ruled against my client. The author of the en banc decision, Judge Sean Gallagher, and I'm mentioning judges only so that we can keep track of who's on the scorecard. Judge Sean Gallagher ruled against me. We respect that. Judge Lisa Forbes dissented not only from the en banc decision, but more importantly from what was issued also on February 23rd of 2003. It's known as motion number 562113. It's the 16th page of my appendix. And that was the order that said that we find that there's a reason for an en banc review. That reason for an en banc review being that they had reviewed a proposed panel decision. We don't know what that really is, other than the fact that there was something that had been generated, which, by the way, in the federal system would have been perfectly proper. That's discussed in the McGeorge Law Review article. But that doesn't work in the Ohio system, where we expect a journalized panel decision. So the second way that I'm prejudiced, to go back to Your Honor's question, is the fact that I have one vote against me from Judge Sean Gallagher. I have one vote for me from Judge Lisa Forbes, or dissenting, I should say, from Judge Lisa Forbes. Judge Brogan, who was sitting by designation as a substitute for Judge Kilbane, Judge Brogan was not part of the en banc panel. And so we don't know how he would have voted. Ironically, Judge Kilbane, for whom Judge Brogan was substituting, also dissented from the en banc decision. And then the panel decision can't count, because the panel decision simply said, we're bound by the en banc court, which is clearly the case. Judge Brogan concurred in that, but that doesn't mean that he exercised independent judgment against my client. 9 of the 10 votes that were cast against my client came from judges who respectfully should not have been deciding this case at this point in the process, and who, had there been a proper panel decision, may well have been in a position where they would have decided there is no conflict, or this court could have reviewed and said there is no conflict, or at least I could have, or predecessor counsel could have seen a panel decision to determine that. That transparency is so missing in this case. It is a transparency that the federal rules do not require. It's a transparent, because of the fact that, as the McGeorge Law Review article talks about, there can be behind the scenes machinations, properly so. But Ohio doesn't do things that way. Beyond that, I would submit to the court that when you have the wrong decision maker, when 9 out of the 10 votes against my client are from the wrong judges, when there can't be review of the decision to grant en banc review in the first instance by this court, that we have a structural error at that point.
Can't we assume that if the initial panel had issued its decision and gone your way, that the court would have taken it en banc?
No, Your Honor, because
why not? The judges have all on the 8th District, or at least the majority of them, have made clear that they think this is an issue that should be decided by the full court?
Your Honor, we don't know what the en banc decision said. The en banc decision may very well have said there are certain situations where a limited remand for resentencing requires the defendant's presence. There's certain situations where it doesn't. But in this case, the mandate that came from the first Maldonado decision was different than either of the mandates in Howard or Jarman. The mandate that came down in the first Maldonado decision in this case was for a resentencing. That was the term. The en banc court had to get around that by saying, well, resentencing is a generic term. It doesn't necessarily mean resentencing, and that the trial courts should basically have the ability to decide what a court of appeals means by the word resentencing. I submit to the court that that creates a whole set of dangers and a slippery slope, but
I just want to make sure I understand the facts as I read them and wrote them down.
Yes, Your Honor.
They had a decision in 2006 and then a decision in 2020.
Yes.
They could have en banc 10 days after the 2020, recognizing the 06 was diametrically opposed to that decision. They chose not to.
Correct.
This case comes into the 8th.
Yes.
And all of a sudden somebody decides we should en banc this without giving it appellate review.
That's correct.
So when you talk about the first case, had the panel reached a decision in the first case?
When I talked about the first case, I meant the first Maldonado case. And the first Maldonado case, which was decided in 2019, was a case, it was a Siena's Law case, and among other things. And that first Maldonado case, it had been remanded to the trial court for resentencing. That was the word. Not a word that was used in either of the two cases that the 8th District en banc cited to with respect to this pre-existing conflict. In the end, I would
get back to Justice Stewart's
please.
Question and Justice DeWine. Okay. Let's say they had an error in the exercise of their jurisdiction.
Yes.
Where's the prejudice? Well, or do you even need to reach that?
I don't believe you need to reach it because it's structural. First of all, the wrong decision maker has made the decision, number one. But number two, the error also comes from the fact that now the 8th District has created a situation where its decision to grant en banc has evaded any review by this court. The decision to create en banc. We don't know if the panel decision in this case really was in conflict with either Howard or Jarman. And so therefore, that's the rub for this court, is that you don't have the ability to review the decision of the Court of Appeals with respect to whether or not there was a conflict in the first instance. In the end, the state suggests that our reading of the rule frustrates the purpose of the rule. Respectfully, I don't think that's the case. Our reading of the rule is true to the rule. It may be that the rule itself doesn't go far enough in the state's opinion. But that's not a decision for this court to make in this context. That's a rulemaking decision. If 26 needs to be changed to be more akin to the federal rules, and this court's not a stranger to having its rules be in sync with the federal rules, then that's for this court's rulemaking process. But it's not for the 8th District to misinterpret respectfully, and no matter how good intentioned, for the 8th District to have done that. I submit that my friend needs to answer, is a panel decision required? Why has the state relied so heavily on federal precedent? And how does the state evade the issue of both the structural and the actual prejudice that comes when 9 of the 10 votes were improperly cast? I've gone over my time. I appreciate the court's indulgence. Unless there's any further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Forshoni.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. My name is Tasha Forshoni on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. To address the first issue, is a panel decision required before the appellate court can pursue en banc proceedings? No. Appellate courts have discretion over en banc procedures.
How do you square that with the plain gist of the rule? Any sua sponte order or designated case for en banc consideration must be entered no later than 10 days after the clerk has mailed the judgment. A party may file an application within 10 days of the date the clerk has both mailed to the parties the judgment or the court. I mean, that seems pretty clear that at least the rule anticipates that there's going to be a judgment before there's en banc consideration.
I think that section of the rule sets forth timing requirements that if there are en banc proceedings, they must be done within a specific time frame, and that's so someone who is appealing the matter further to this court knows when they are on the clock to file their appeal. There's nothing in the
rule. It's a time requirement not just for someone, for a litigant. It says any sua sponte order. So that's for the court, too.
I think that is so that litigants know when they need to file their appeal to this court.
So you think how do litigants know anything under the procedure that the 8th District followed?
Here, we knew that the en banc proceedings happened with the release of the journal entry saying the court had accepted the case for en banc review and with the release of the opinion. Now, if the appellant or even the state had a problem with that decision, we both had recourse. We could file a reconsideration from that decision. We could also file a jurisdictional appeal to this court. So neither of the parties are without recourse. But to get back to the prohibitions, there is nothing in the rule that prohibits what happened here. There's nothing that says, particularly in subsection A2A, that says a panel decision must be released before en banc proceedings can happen.
So are you suggesting that the court, when it writes rules that are then later adopted by the General Assembly, that they have to address every single prohibition under the sun in order for you not to read in something into the rule that doesn't exist?
I don't think that they have to write in every prohibition. That would be impossible. But there are prohibitions in this rule. There's really one prohibition in this rule, and that's, to quote, a court of appeals may not consider a case en banc until after a decision has been Let me quote it correctly. Consideration en banc will not be ordered unless necessary to secure and maintain uniformity of decisions within the district on an issue that is dispositive in the case in which the application is filed. So that, to us, is the only prohibition that's in the rule.
Okay, and then it says that once they determine that there's this conflict, they have, as Justice DeWine just read, 10 days from the date of that judgment to actually state they're going to hold an en banc proceeding. And the cases that were allegedly in conflict, one's from 2006 and one's from 2020. And now they're doing this when a new case is coming in, rightfully a first right of appeal, and it to be heard by a panel.
I think if they wanted a prohibition in the rule, they could have put that language in to say, may not do this until, must be a panel decision first. Any manner of ways they could have put the language in there, but it's not in there.
Doesn't that really cut the other way, though? I mean, there's any manner of ways they could have said a court doesn't need to wait for a judgment, but they chose not to do that.
And that leads me to what I think is the best argument for why what the 8th District did was okay here. And that is subsection A2E. That's really a catch-all provision that says that appellate courts are allowed to adopt their own procedures for en banc proceedings through either order or through rule. They did
as
that in this
they
case.
They don't conflict with the actual appellate rules as adopted by the General Assembly, because we use the rules, but they have the force of law since they're adopted as rules. So wouldn't that be a conflict that they can just choose to hold an en banc on any case at any time when we have a 10-day limitation?
I agree, Your Honor, that they can't promulgate any rules that are in conflict with anything with the appellate rules or any orders in local rules or orders in conflict with the appellate rules. I respectfully disagree that the rule is in conflict. We don't think there's a prohibition, and we think that catch-all provision in subsection E allows them the discretion to do what they did in this case.
So two things here. First of all, the rule says, as prescribed by local rule or as otherwise ordered by the court, don't you kind of keep the parties in the dark if they just make up a rule with an order when they feel like it would work? And this leads into the other question of, there's a benefit to following the process deliberately of releasing a decision, filing a motion for reconsideration, allowing whichever, the state or the defendant, to bring issues to the court where they think perhaps the court wasn't correct in the law or missed something crucial in the record. Before you jump all the way to an en banc panel, aren't you depriving the parties of the ability to make their arguments regarding the decision that's actually required to be issued by the court?
We would have liked notice in this case. We would have liked a panel decision
Let me ask you about that. So you represent the prosecutor's office.
I didn't get an answer to my question.
Well, go ahead, finish your answer.
But we're stuck with what happened here and the facts of this case and what happened. It's a really unique circumstance. There was a conflict in the 8th District. It spanned a long while.
That conflict over here began in 2020.
Yes.
And they didn't do anything within 10 days of that decision, did they?
No, because there was no adverse decision to the state. The state lost the rule, but didn't lose the case, didn't lose the appeal, because the court found it was harmless error. And that is likely why the state didn't file an en banc.
Okay, let me ask you about that. You represent the state, you represent the prosecutor's office. You're here defending this judgment because you like the result. But does the prosecutor's office really want a procedure where the 8th District could have secret en banc proceedings that you don't have any notice of, that you're not aware of, that you don't have an opportunity to argue before the en banc court? I mean, is that what you really want?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, and well, that's what we're going to get. You're going to get if we rule in favor of you.
Well, but do you ever have an opportunity to argue in front of the en banc court?
Sometimes. The 8th District has done a little bit of a course correction. There is a proposed rule which we supplemented in which they are suggesting that once there is a sua sponte acceptance of a case for en banc review, the parties will receive notice. We like that. And also providing for briefing that once a case is accepted.
But that's not in place now.
No, it is a proposed rule that is open for comment, I believe, until January 19th.
Do you know of any case in the 8th District where parties have had the opportunity to brief it and argue it?
Yes.
En
banc. Yes, Your Honor.
By request or sua sponte, the court allows it?
There were a couple of Reagan-Tokes cases that did proceed to en banc briefing and oral argument. With all that being said, we are asking this case to be dismissed as improvidently allowed because of its unique circumstances. There is no prejudice to Mr. Maldonado. 10 out of the 12 judges granted to vote en banc review.
Wait a minute. The General Assembly has decided to allow individuals a first right of appeal. Under the rules, under the statute, he was entitled to argue his case between three members of the court and entitled to a decision from that panel. He didn't get that. Instead, what he got was a secret proceeding by the judges of the 8th District to hold an en banc, which nobody knew about, and then all of a sudden, there's this decision. How is that procedurally fair to him?
I don't know that I agree that the proceedings were secret, because...
So he got notice?
He did not. Well, we received the February 2023 entry letting us know that the case was accepted for en banc review, but a decision, both a panel decision was released and the en banc decision was released, and if Mr. Maldonado took issue with the findings in that en banc decision, he could have filed for a reconsideration, and he did not do that. So I don't think he was without recourse here. So, and I want to point out that he makes the argument only one judge ruled against him, or that he may have been successful on the panel, but that's not necessarily true because Judge Gallagher and Judge Brogan decided the appeal in the state's favor. So I don't know where that calculation's coming from, but we know that 10 of the 12 judges accepted the case for en banc review. So let's say this case goes to panel. The state hypothetically loses at the panel. We're going to very likely apply for en banc review. And we know that 10 of the 12 judges are going to take the case for en banc review because they've already voted to do so. And beyond that, we know how at least 9 of the 12 judges are going to vote on the merits. They've held that Mr. Maldonado on the merits did not have a right to be present because his sentence was not changed at all.
So you just ignore the law and let it happen?
In this particular case...
Is that a yes? You ignore the law and let it happen?
I guess we disagree about the interpretation of the law. We don't think the 8th District ignored the law.
So rules adopted by the court and accepted by the General Assembly do not have the force of law?
Yes, they do.
Okay, so we ignore the law?
I think that we think they complied with the law. Okay. We think they, in their discretion, that the court, in its discretion, issued an order taking this is just such a unique circumstance because there's no oral argument in this case. That may have helped the discussion along a little bit. What we can surmise happened is that this case gets to conference of a three-judge panel. They're starting to look at it, and they realize, yikes, there's two cases that are conflicting on the rules. So they propose a decision, and they circulate that to the entire court, which is consistent with APRIL A2A for the entire court to consider the case en banc, and they should. So.
But isn't this the whole problem with this? I mean, you don't have any idea actually what happened. You're hypothesizing what you think probably happened in this case. But no one knows because there's no transparency because the 8th District didn't follow the rules. I mean, aren't you really highlighting the problem here that we have to guess what happened?
We know a little bit about what happened from that journal entry that came out in February 2023, and that's where they say that there was a proposed decision in this case and that it needed to be submitted to the en banc court because there was a conflicting issue on a dispositive issue of law in Mr. Maldonado's case. So we know at least that from that February 2023 journal entry. I guess, to close, if there was a prohibition from doing this, it should have been in the rule. With that even said, subsection E is a catch-all which, right or wrongly, allows appellate courts the discretion to issue orders and rulings because they need the ability to control their own dockets and control the logistics and deal with cases like this. And finally, we don't think that there was a structural error or a lack of jurisdiction in this case. A violation of the rule in this case did not mean that the judges could not vote, could not cast their votes. En banc proceedings existed far before this rule existed. The courts are maintaining their jurisdiction and deriving their jurisdiction not just from this rule, but from this court's prior precedents, and that's talked about in Ray J.J. and McFadden. So with that in mind, we don't think it's accurate to say that a violation of the rule, if there was one, would deprive the court of the ability to cast the votes in this case.
Couldn't the 8th District have done it within 10 days of Harmon? Mm-hmm. Isn't that when they were supposed to do it?
Say that again, Your Honor.
The 8th District, if there was an intra-district conflict, supposed to do it within 10 days of the Jarman decision. Isn't that when it was supposed to happen? Under the rule?
I don't know that it had to. Yes, it could have. Yes.
It had to.
Yes, it could have.
After 10 days, is there anything left?
They could have no. I mean, that conflict was certainly out there, and
it was sitting there for two or three years, right?
My time is up, but may I add one final thought? That's what's crazy about this case is, why should they let a conflict linger? They notice that these two cases are out there that are in conflict, and they're.
Why couldn't they wait for the panel decision?
Because then there's a third decision out there.
Yeah.
Which one do the litigants follow while all this goes on?
While they wait for the en banc to decide, right? Within 10 days of the panel decision.
And if they decide to hold an en banc 10 days after, according to the law.
With all that said, we would respectfully ask the case be dismissed as improvidently allowed.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Mr. Martin, you've used your time. We'll give you a minute.
Counsel, I have a question. Is there any judge on the 8th District not disqualified from hearing this case if we send it back?
I'm thinking no. There is no one who's not disqualified at this point in that they have.
What do we do?
So if the court rules in your favor, do you vacate the en banc? What do you do? Justice Fisher?
You vacate the en banc. It has to be remanded for a decision by a panel. And I suppose you could say that Judge Brogan has not been disqualified because he did not participate in the en banc decision. But beyond that, I think everybody else has been poisoned.
All the sitting judges.
All the sitting
of the
judges.
8th District.
All the sitting judges. This court has had in the past to borrow from other districts or from visiting judges in situations where there's been a panel or a court's recusal and would have to employ that again here. I would like to
add. Would that mean they would have to start over with the panel decision?
Yes, Your Honor, they would have to start over with the panel decision at this point. Is that efficient? No. And it wouldn't have happened had the cart been put after the horse instead of before the horse. I would like to answer, I know I've gone way over now, Justice Stewart's question about has the 8th District ever entertained en banc argument? I believe the case was State versus Del Valle, which was the 8th District's en banc decision with respect to Reagan-Tokes. But also, there is a case pending right now in this court at the jurisdictional level, as well as, I believe, at the conflict level, and that's State versus Jayden Logan, in which there was also an en banc oral argument. I have a recollection that there's another one, but I apologize. It's not at my fingertips.
That's fine. No, and the state prosecutor answered the question, too. To follow up on Justice Bruner's question, or Justice Fisher, one who said, is there anyone who's not, is disqualified from the Eighth? You said no one. Judge Brogan could sit again. Then take it to the next question. If that's the case and it goes en banc, is the entire 8th District off the case? Will there have to be a 12 visiting judges, Chief Justice, en banc decision?
The rule talks about the fact that if there is not an en banc decision that comes from the court, then the panel decision, I'm going to go back to where I started, the panel decision remains. So I think that there would be two different interpretations. I would submit the better interpretation would be there cannot be an en banc determination in this case at that point. The panel decision has to remain, and then at that point.
And possibly the conflict remain until another case comes along and the court, current makeup of the court is purged and can then reconsider or en banc that decision?
That could be the case, although I would submit respectfully to the court and respectfully to the 8th District, as we explained in our brief, there is no conflict. Okay. Howard and Jarman can very much live in simpatico.
You've said that before, but if it went back to a new three-judge panel and essentially the 8th District would not be in a position to sua sponte en banc, but a party could move for en banc and then other judges could be brought in. That would be the rub, correct?
That would be the other route to go. The problem then is...
The problem is that then there would be no sua sponte en banc because you can't, unless the chief decided to bring other judges in or we said to bring other judges in and let them decide if they wanted to do it sua sponte, unless, I mean, it's really awkward either way.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would submit to the court that it undermines the en banc process, and at that point underscores why there should just not be en banc available in this case. Because the problem is this: if this court turns around and says, for example, that the 5-judge 7th District will now sit en banc to render a decision for the 12-judge 8th District, we've got a situation where we have a geographical morass, and it's really not the en banc decision of the 8th District in any way, shape, or form.
Except how is that different if there's a particular judge on a court of appeals who is the subject of litigation? None of the court can sit on that case, and it has to by necessity go to a different court. I mean, I don't think there's anything against that, do you?
Well, no, in that situation, you certainly have to go to another court for purposes of a panel decision. But whether you can go to another court for purposes of an en banc decision is a question that, frankly, I didn't fully anticipate today, and I apologize for that. But secondly, I would submit to the court that at that point, 26A's or 26B's application for en banc consideration would go to the issue of you don't have the ability to have an en banc decision, therefore the panel decision has to remain. In the end, the 8th District's skewed en banc analysis can obviously not get a pass by virtue of the fact that their error has so convoluted the process as to make a remedy difficult. And that is the situation in which, unfortunately, they have placed this court. If there's no further questions, Your Honor has been very indulgent, and I thank the court.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll receive a decision from the court.